Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what's behind an increase in hate incidents across the country and why showerheads have become a controversial topic in some circles. But first, the Trump administration's education department has rescinded a multi-million dollar fine against Grand Canyon University. The Biden administration had levied the $37.7 million fine against the university in 2023, accusing GCU of misrepresenting the cost to students of getting doctoral degrees. The education department at the time said that ended up costing students thousands of dollars more than they'd expected to pay. With me now to talk more about this is Helen Rummel, who covers higher education for the Arizona Republic. Good morning, Helen.
Good morning.
So what exactly did GCU or were they accused of doing by the Biden Education Department? Like how were they maybe not telling students, according to the allegations, how much their doctorates would cost?
So in 2023, the U.S. Department of Education came out with this multi-million dollar fine, and they said that it was regarding severe misrepresentation of their doctoral degrees. They specifically cited an internal investigation that said they had misrepresented costs to more than 7,500 students. And the department said that roughly around 2% of the students who had completed their degrees with the university had done so within the costs advertised. And they, as a response, released this fine and had done so in saying that these were students who had faced higher student loans and were facing a significant amount of costs as a result.
We should point out that GCU officials had, from the start, denied these allegations, said there was nothing to them. What changed, I guess, other than the change in administration, like what is the Education Department now saying about why it is relieving the university of these fines?
Yes, leaders at GCU have long said that there is no merit to these claims and have fiercely denied the university, saying that they are actually within compliance and that they have been disclosed more than is legally required, such as pointing to tools as their online degree program calculator and other disclosures. They have said that this is just an example of them finding no fines or liabilities or penalties of any kind. A joint stipulation of dismissal from the Department of Education's Office of Hearings and Appeals dismissed the case entirely. And they received, they also shared a response with me from a spokesperson who said that this was just an example of how the Trump administration will continue to ensure how every institution of higher education is held based on facts, but the department enforcement will be for the purpose of serving students, not political bias. And that was a statement from a U.S. Department of Education spokesperson from earlier this week.
Do GCU officials seem vindicated by this change?
Yes. So GCU's president, Brian Mueller, said that the fine dismissal was welcome news. And he shared a statement saying, quote, "The facts clearly support our contention that we were wrongly accused of misleading our doctoral students. And we appreciate the recognition that those accusations were without merit." Like I said, GCU has long had the opinion that the Department of Education was engaging in government overreach, and they felt that they had been wrongfully targeted by the Biden administration when this fine was issued in 2023.
Helen, let me ask you about something else GCU-related that came out just a very short while ago, which is that the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, has reaffirmed the university's nonprofit status. This has been a years-long debate, I guess, right, between GCU and the federal government when it should. Is it really a nonprofit, a for-profit? Now it's back to being a nonprofit. What is the significance of becoming regaining its nonprofit status to GCU?
Yeah, like you said, this has been a long-standing debate between multiple federal institutions and the university. So just this morning, the university announced that the IRS had reaffirmed its 501c3 status. And so what that means is they are now tax-exempt as an Arizona nonprofit institution. And this comes after a four-year examination from the IRS that is coming to the same conclusion that they originally came to. And this is significant, and it puts it in line with several other organizations that view GCU as a nonprofit organization, a nonprofit institution. So that includes the Higher Learning Commission, the State of Arizona, and the Arizona Private Postsecondary Board of Education. For the school, this is significant and is another institution that is going to view them as both the nonprofit that they have continued to fight for the status of, and for the tax exempt status, obviously, is very significant for a university of that size.
Is it fair to say that this is important for GCU both from a financial standpoint, but also from an academic and sort of reputational standpoint?
Yes, I think that this, alongside the revocation of the fine in March, is a sign of different organizations coming to conclusions that the university was hoping for. And so I think it is significant in both financial and perhaps other reasons as well.
All right. That is Helen Rummel, who covers higher education for the Arizona Republic. Helen, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Anti-Defamation League reports there were more than 9,300 incidents of anti-Semitic harassment, vandalism, and assault in the U.S. last year. That's a more than 300% increase from half a decade ago. Arizona has also seen an increase in anti-Semitic incidents. But it's not just anti-Semitism that's been on the rise. Experts say there's been an increase of lots of kinds of hate over the past few years. And my next guests say that's dangerous for everyone. I sat down recently with Reverend Katie Sexton, Executive Director of the Arizona Faith Network, and Rabbi Andy Green of Congregation Or Tzion in Scottsdale. Last month, they wrote an op-ed on this that was published in the Arizona Mirror, and I asked each of them how they define hate. We started with Reverend Sexton.
That is a great question, and I think it's one that is kind of being redefined right now in our society as we're seeing a lot of changes in how we are having intolerance of one another through our leadership in politics and in a lot of civic organizations, nonprofits, and even religious institutions. For me, hate is really just complete intolerance. Just bigotry of another group or people. And a lot of times that it's hard not to jump right to the violence for me, because that's where we've been in the interfaith space. We've been living in the prevention of violence space and reaction to violence space. But I bet Rabbi has a better definition than I do.
I'm not sure if I would define differently, but just to add to what Reverend Sexton shared, there's an element of blame and scapegoating that happens when an individual or group is hated, and often it's related to people trying to weaponize the suffering and struggle of individuals, you know, as we face tough economic conditions, being able to say, it's not your fault, it's them, or it's that person, it's that leader, it's that group, and then motivate individuals to act out on that hatred, on that bigotry, on that anger concerning their own situation. And all of us are comforted when we're told that the suffering we experience is not our fault.
It's interesting the point you make about sort of getting others to act on it and maybe acting on it yourself as well, because that seems to sort of go speak to the idea of, you know, protected hate speech versus not protected hate action.
One of the blessings of our Constitution is freedom of speech, that our First Amendment allows us to express ourselves and to express opinions and positions that are unpopular. I think one of the challenges of that is often that people will defend hateful rhetoric, will defend foolish speech by being able to say, it's free speech, I'm free to express myself. And that when we fail to challenge speech that is foolish, speech that is bigoted, speech that motivates hateful actions, and call that out, there's a great danger there. When somebody says something that is demonstrably false, when somebody blames another group for their problems, when somebody targets the Jewish faith, for example, and I have myself been targeted with threats by individuals who genuinely believe that their suffering is due to me and to my community, even though I promise you we have no power when it comes to this particular individual, and that before being approached and threatened by them, I had never heard of their circumstance or of them.
So, Reverend Sexton, how do you sort of look at that line that Rabbi Green was talking about in terms of being able to express yourself, which, of course, the First Amendment allows all of us to do and protects the ability of all of us to do, versus taking it that next step and maybe leading someone or yourself to do something, or just maybe fostering an environment in which it's considered acceptable to commit some kind of hate act against a person or group?
Yeah, echoing that, we have every right to hold any belief, and we have every right to hold any opinion or speech in our lives. That's who we are as America. But we're seeing this play out in real life right now in front of us. We've seen this play out since January 6th, for instance. We've seen this play out on our news screens every day, too, of where folks are moving this hate and blame that Rabbi was talking about into action and retribution for these false beliefs of others causing pain or taking away, or just by their presence or their identity or their race, that they are then taking something, the scarcity mindset that we're seeing in our culture from someone else. And so it is that line of where speech moves to action or threats, or makes people feel like their liberties are threatened. We all have the right to feel safe, to feel free, to be able to move throughout our lives on a daily basis without feeling like we're going to be harmed just for who we are, how we worship, or how we identify.
Rabbi Green, I want to ask if you have the sense that, not within the Jewish community necessarily, but in the broader community, do people understand what anti-Semitism is and maybe to an extent what it isn't?
The answer is no. A big part of that is that anti-Semitism in and of itself is a confusing word. It refers to hatred of Jews, but often because of its technical language, and the term was originally coined by German academics who hated Jews to sound highfalutin and academic and justified, that is where the term comes from, and that anti-Semitism exists not only in the expression of hatred of Jews for being Jews, but also in the stereotyping of all Jews as being monolithic and a force that is against whatever a person values. One of the things that's dangerous about anti-Semitism, and I think on some level all forms of hatred, is the way in which whatever somebody values is projected on those that are hated. So in the case of the Jewish community, right, you saw folks in Charlottesville chanting, "The Jews will not replace us." These were white supremacists who saw Jews as the ultimate race polluters, because for them, race and purity of white bloodline is important. And Jews, some of us, look white, but to them, we're not white. And then you see in some of the anti-Semitism that exists on the far left that Jews are the whitest whites who ever whited, right? That there's a projection on what happens in Israel right now in the current war of race dynamics in America that don't actually match the experience of Israelis and Palestinians, and that this reflects the way in which so often anti-Semitism is about the projection of whatever a person finds as evil onto the Jewish idea. Mm.
Does it make it more difficult to try to combat anti-Semitism when, as you say, it's a little bit confusing as to what exactly constitutes it?
I think that combating anti-Semitism involves confronting the reality that all anti-Semitism is a conspiracy theory, that it is rooted in the idea that Jews are demonic or superhuman or have some power beyond the power that we have. Believe me, if Jews actually controlled the courts and controlled Hollywood and controlled all these different things that anti-Semites often claim that we do, we wouldn't see the same rise in anti-Jewish hatred and bigotry that we found.
That's Rabbi Andy Green with Congregation Or Tzion in Scottsdale. Reverend Katie Sexton is Executive Director of the Arizona Faith Network. We'll have more of our conversation in just a moment. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how a veteran's military service unlocked lost family history and reshaped how he viewed others and himself. But first, let's return now to my conversation on hate with Reverend Katie Sexton, Executive Director of the Arizona Faith Network, and Rabbi Andy Green of Scottsdale's Congregation Or Tzion. We spoke earlier, and I asked Reverend Sexton what she's seen in her work in terms of not just increases in anti-Semitism, which have been pretty well documented, but an increase in hate against all sorts of groups, religious or otherwise.
Yeah, the religious-based hate and other hate against community groups has really changed and grown over the last few years. It's really changed since, to be honest, January. We have seen—
January of this year.
And we've seen just in this year churches down in the Tucson area and down to the border have a hate and attacks and trespassers within them that are seeking to help migrants, for example. And these are congregations that are predominantly Christian, predominantly white, predominantly middle class or upper class that have been doing immigration and refugee and asylum seeker ministry for decades that are now under threat like they have never been before. And to be honest, they don't know how to respond.
So what do we do about this? Like, what is the answer? Because you can't force someone to think something that they don't. So, like, what do we do about this?
You know, one of our great teachers in my denomination is Dr. William Barber, who leads the Poor People's Campaign. And he refers to this as Martin Luther King Jr. did, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., as a morality problem, right? One thing we're doing at Arizona Faith Network in partnership with the ADL here in Arizona, the JCRC, and our LGBTQ plus community, One Community, is we've started what we're calling a Safe Communities Foundation, or a Safe Communities Coalition, my apologies. And this coalition is bringing together historically disenfranchised and targeted groups. So our LGBTQ plus community, our religious minorities, so the Jewish, the Muslim communities, it's bringing together our indigenous communities and so many more to a table where we're both info sharing and employing some intel analysts to be watching just the folks that we know are KKK members here in the state or members of other hate groups and doing like a deeper dive hate watch. And so we gather now monthly to intel share and then also rapid respond when incidents happen.
Rabbi Green, what do you think is the answer here? What do we do about this?
I think that two things. First is that I think that the victims of hatred shouldn't be responsible for preventing it. And that it is an unfair expectation, for example, to blame the Jewish community for anti-Semitism. That in and of itself is an anti-Semitic idea. To blame the communities of color for racism is an unfair and to say that it is on those communities to respond in some way and to educate. And if only we had one more, if I invited this KKK member to my house for a Sabbath dinner, they would see the beauty of Jewish community and Jewish life, and they would think, wow, everything that I've taught, everything that I've believed up until this time is wrong. Which, of course, there are instances and stories of precisely that happening, but it's dangerous for us to think that that responsibility rests on the victims of this kind of hatred. The second thing is, what can we actually do? We can have conversations. We can try not to express judgment about an entire group of people based on the individual that we know or the few individuals that we have seen on amplified in media who so often are not representative of a community but representative of particular extremes in lots of different respects.
Yeah. And just to add to that, too, I think one thing we really can do is hold people accountable. I think we have to hold one another accountable. We have to hold our communities accountable. And especially we have to hold our elected officials accountable.
So I want to end by asking each of you if you see reasons for optimism in the community. I mean, we've been talking a lot about how much horrible stuff is happening with all sorts of hatred, anti-Semitism and otherwise. Reverend Sexton, do you see reasons for optimism?
I always do. I am an optimist by nature. And so for me, it always comes down to the individuals, to the people that we are still able to sit down and have coffee with and talk about. And, you know, within my own family, we have such different political opinions, and yet we love one another and still are able to sit down at the table. I think right now we are in a struggle of defining really who we are and who we are going to be as a community and a country. And that in and of itself is hopeful. The fact that we are naming these things is hopeful because it means we are struggling with what is being said. And if we were just being quiet and we weren't stressed or worried about any of this, then that means we have given up. And so there is hope in the struggle. There is hope in what's coming next. And there is hope in all of the relationships we hold dear.
Rabbi Green, do you see reasons for hope, reasons for optimism?
It has been much harder to be a Jew publicly, particularly since October 7th of 2023, and the way in which vitriol and blame for the Jewish community, targeting the Jewish community, I was feeling much more hopeful a couple years ago than I am now. Doesn't mean that things won't get better, and there are certainly signs for hope. I think that Americans understand that the Jewish community is vulnerable, that Jews didn't steal land in 1948, that Israel deserves to exist entirely independently of the genocide that targeted the Jewish people just years before in the Holocaust. People are feeling in my community a great deal of fear, but the things that give me hope are that our government here in the United States and also the Jewish nation, the Jewish state in Israel, exist and see themselves as protectors of Jewish community against those that hate us, instead of encouraging that hate and targeting the Jewish community the way that most governments that Jews lived under prior to this century experienced. And so though there are many comparisons that those in my community have made to the rise of Nazism nearly 100 years ago and comparing it to this time, those fundamental differences, the fact that our police are here to protect me when I'm targeted with a death threat rather than to encourage those who hate me, that is a huge difference and a reason to hope. And a reason to understand that we're in a much better place than we were.
All right. Rabbi Andy Green is with Congregation Ortzion in Scottsdale. Reverend Katie Sexton, Executive Director of the Arizona Faith Network. Thanks you both for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A new public art exhibition considers the impacts of climate change. My co-host Sam Dingman has the story.
Earlier this year, on March 12th, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin announced a series of actions designed to roll back much of the work the EPA did under previous presidential administrations. Much of that work was intended to counteract the dangerous impacts of climate change. Those impacts, the agency has long held, are the result of greenhouse gas emissions. It's an assertion based on something called the endangerment finding, which is one of those government phrases that sounds kind of dry and procedural. But the endangerment finding is actually pretty dramatic and direct. It was announced back in 2009 during the first Obama administration, and it says, quote, "Greenhouse gases taken in combination endanger both the public health and the public welfare of current and future generations." But on March 12th, Lee Zeldin said the EPA would now begin a formal process of reconsidering the endangerment finding. In a YouTube video accompanying his announcement, Zeldin dismissed climate concerns as part of what he and President Trump have called a scam. The endangerment finding, Zeldin declared, was just ideology.
I've been told the endangerment finding is considered the holy grail of the climate change religion.
Now, you might expect people who believe climate change is a clear and present danger to bristle at Zeldin's framing of their concerns as religion rather than science. But I recently met a textile artist who sort of embraces it.
You know, these are 2,500 prayers that are going up to just remind people that we have one planet.
The artist is Ann Morton. We spoke a few weeks ago, standing at the edge of her new public art installation, currently on view at the Desert Botanical Garden. It's called Toward 2050, and it's a circular labyrinth with a quarter-mile path that winds towards the center. The walkway is lined with pieces of fabric, each 10 inches square.
They're painted, they're sewn, they're embroidered, they're woven. There's some eco-printing in here where people have used leaves to actually print on the fabric. So there's all kinds of different techniques.
Back in 2023, Morton put out a call for fellow artists to make textile works inspired by the climate crisis. About 2,500 people from all over the country responded. Morton mailed them blank squares of fabric with a very simple prompt.
Just to make something that represented something they cared about in their world, in their environment.
When the artists finished their projects, they sent them back to Morton. The pieces range from abstract paintings of sunsets and rainbows and mountains to text-based designs. Several are variations on the phrase, "There is no planet B."
They're just really meant to ignite that contemplation about climate change and how we're treating our world and, you know, taking care of the place that we live.
Morton refers to the decorated fabrics as prayer flags, though she's careful to point out that she doesn't want people to think she's co-opting the Tibetan tradition of prayer flags. In fact, she says, the intended audience for these flags isn't any deity. It's a group of mere mortals.
When the makers signed up to make the flags, for every flag they signed up for, they got a postcard to send to their lawmakers. So, you know, we probably have a few thousand of those postcards in circulation going to lawmakers, just talking about climate change and to remember that in every sector, for every policy, consider climate change as part of the consideration when you're making policy, because it really affects everything. It affects agriculture, it affects water use, it affects transportation, it affects everything.
Morton has another goal in mind for visitors to the labyrinth. As they make their way through the rows of flags, they walk across metal plates with years printed on them, 2025, 2035, all the way up to 2050. Barring significant action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, 2050 is the year that many scientists agree is the point of no return, the year human life will be irreparably endangered.
And so one thing that happens as you cross every year, you start to see that's only 25 years from now that we have to really make a huge reversal in the greenhouse gases that we are emitting in our world.
At the center of the labyrinth, there's a Wendell Berry quote, "The earth is what we all have in common."
It's very simple, but very true, right? We have a lot of angst and opposition in this world, but we're all on the same planet. So we better stop and start working together. You know, we're not going to survive and none of the politics will matter.
Morton's message is unity. But she knows there's something slightly subversive about her project. It was important to her that the flags were communally sourced. She wanted to evoke the idea of a sewing circle, where people gather to gossip and talk about how to deal with collective problems.
This is just another iteration of that.
And people often talk politics at those, right?
They do. They'll talk politics or, you know, what they like or don't like in their community, what's going on with their families. And so it's all part of that story of textiles. you know, textiles just has just a rich history in American protest and worldwide protest, where women have used their skills in textiles to make banners or flags or raise funds for a for a cause. And so I just love kind of using those, what are considered women's work or home crafts, and actually make a very hard-hitting statement with that. That's what I like. It's being, I'm kind of soft-spoken, but I love that maybe my art can be a little more brash.
Ann Morton's prayer flag installation, Toward 2050, is on view at Desert Botanical Garden until June 1st.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Last month, President Trump signed an executive order that promises, as the headline suggests, to, quote, make showers great again. The order rolls back a federal rule that defines the word showerhead and aims to allow for higher water pressure in American showers. Showerheads seem to be just the latest aspect of our homes that have become political flashpoints. Think LED light bulbs and gas stoves. This year, congressional Republicans have worked to undo some of the efficiency rules approved at the end of the Biden administration, including on items like gas-powered water heaters and commercial refrigeration equipment. And some advocates of rules requiring more energy-efficient appliances worry the Trump administration is looking for a way around a law that stops the government from weakening efficiency standards. Kate Yoder has been reporting on this. She's a staff writer at GRIST, which is a climate news site. She joins me. And Kate, how did it come to be that we as a nation are talking about showerheads?
Well, showerheads are an interesting one. I guess most recently, the Biden administration had revived this rule that tried to save water by restricting flow from showerheads. And, you know, Trump had repealed this rule in his last term, and he repealed it again just recently, like he did last time. And the White House released a fact sheet that said that the order would make America's showers great again, and painted this as sort of a response to what they called the left's war on water pressure. And it's interesting because showerheads have actually been a point of contention since the 1990s, when these, you know, energy efficiency standards were and water efficiency standards were being introduced. And there's actually a Seinfeld episode that there's a great clip to watch where like Jerry Kramer and Newman are all complaining about the new low flow showerheads in their building ruining their showers. And they end up buying like higher flow showerheads on the black market from the back of a guy's truck.
These showers are horrible. There's no pressure. I can't get the shampoo out of my hair.
Me either.
If I don't have a good shower, I am not myself. I feel weak and ineffectual. I'm not Kramer.
You, what about me? I got the Tonight Show tonight. I'm gonna have to shower in the dressing room. Oh. Where are you going?
Well, I gotta find another shower.
And, you know, I think it indicates that, you know, that maybe there were some real issues when efficient appliances were first introduced that people noticed. But actually, since then, manufacturers have made a lot of improvements to make sure that these products work well, you know, and often better than these older inefficient models.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like at least over the past couple of years, at least in sort of popular conversation, it's been more about, you know, the government, take your hands off my gas stoves than, you know, keep your hands out of my shower.
Yeah, I look a lot at climate and culture and polarization. And one of the interesting things is it's not just about gas stoves. You know, last year I came across these bills that Republicans in the House had passed, and they were called things like the Refrigerator Freedom Act and Liberty and Laundry Act. So I really started wondering, like, what's going on here? Like, why are we talking about freedom when it comes to refrigerators? And like, what's so political about dishwashers and laundry machines and other things that are being targeted in this legislation? So that was definitely in the back of my head when, you know, Trump passed this order about showerheads. And then also, of course, the gas stove drama that started flaring up in, I think that was around 2019.
Do we typically find some kind of backlash to efforts to change or restrict the kinds of appliances or the things we put in our homes? Like, I remember there's a lot of uproar about light bulbs. And we talked about gas stoves and now shower heads and maybe refrigerators. Like, is it just sort of an accepted thing in the policy world that when changes like these are either requested or mandated, there's some number of people who are going to say no thanks?
It's definitely been there since the beginning. Like, even though there's been a lot of bipartisan support for these things, they've always sort of been a political football in the way that, like, certain appliances or rules will sort of flare up and become controversial. And one of the really big talking points has been around consumer choice, or like the freedom of choice for consumers who like want to purchase low-cost appliances. Because even though, you know, energy efficient appliances tend to be a little bit higher cost up front, even if, you know, over the long term, they're saving people hundreds of dollars on bills.
So does this then indicate maybe to climate activists or just people who are generally in favor of the newer, more efficient appliances and technology that they need to figure out a different way to approach it or at least to talk about it?
It's a great question because, you know, even though these certain items have been swept up in the culture wars, like people don't want products that needlessly waste energy and money. So if you look at recent polling, for example, like 87% of Americans think there should be at least a minimum efficiency level for different home appliances. And that even included 82% of Republicans. So I'm not sure it's like if we need to message these differently or if there's just a question of like, how do you approach energy efficiency in such a polarized environment?
What do we see people actually buying when they are able to choose, for example, what kind of shower head they want or what kind of refrigerator they want or what kind of stove they want? Like, do people tend to make the choice to be more efficient on their own?
It's interesting because there's not really an easy way for people to compare the efficiency of a product. Like, say you're going to go buy a fridge, you might look online or at a store and be like, oh, this option is slightly cheaper. And then you wouldn't realize like, oh, this one is actually more inefficient and it's going to cost me $100 more a year indefinitely. And so because those costs can add up to thousands of dollars, like that's a really big deal. So essentially, if you have these standards in place, you're guaranteeing a better long-term deal with people so they aren't getting stuck with these unnecessary bills. But there is like a trade-off in terms of them being a little more expensive upfront.
So what do folks who are in this world think is the future of these kinds of technologies in terms of energy efficient, water efficient, you know, low flow shower heads, things like that? Like, is this going to continue to be a political and maybe a social and cultural fight into the future?
I mean, I think it's likely to stay polarizing just because we haven't seen a lot of, you know, tempering of those trends generally. I think, you know, where the culture wars can actually flare up about this, not just in legislation, but, you know, into like a broader sort of controversy is when people notice changes affecting their lives. And, you know, often I think that as the country has gotten more polarized, people's perceptions of like what's good and bad are often kind of based around group identity. And in a way, that's sort of what has happened with these standards. So I think that's my interpretation of why these objects, even though they seem innocuous, like are becoming kind of more political. Like, how could a shower head ever be controversial, you know?
Yeah. Well, I kind of wonder, you know, based on what you just said, like, is it really about the shower head or the stove or the light bulb? Or is that just sort of a symbol of a bigger issue, maybe a bigger complaint that people have?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's sort of this issue about consumer choice, which obviously goes back, you know, several decades. And another piece of it is that companies that have sort of a stake in promoting these products, like, you know, gas stoves and gas water heaters and that sort of thing, they actually have, you know, a coordinated campaign to like kind of promote this freedom to choose, you know, what energy type you prefer kind of messaging. And it's interesting because that message has even made it, you know, to the Trump administration. Like, Chris Wright is the energy secretary, mm-hmm. and one of his top priorities is to promote affordability and consumer choice in home appliances. So that's, I think, really the central argument that we've seen here.
All right. Kate Yoder is senior staff writer at Grist. Kate, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. In his new memoir, Roadside, Iraq veteran Dylan Park Pettifer tells the unlikely story of his decision to enlist in the military. Or at least, he thought it was an unlikely story back when it was happening. In the years since he returned from the war and began reflecting on his experience, his perception has shifted. As he recently told my co-host Sam Dingman, perhaps it was kind of inevitable.
You know, not to drop names, but I remember I was talking to Seth Rogen when I was writing this. You know, I was telling him about my family history, and I think he called me the Black Lieutenant Dan, because I didn't realize that, like, there's been a member of the Pettiford family that has participated in every conflict in American history, including the Revolution. I don't know if generational trauma is the right phrase, but yeah, I mean, those are my people. So I wanted to share them with the world.
Well, and you also write about discovering the military service of family members on your mom's side, the Korean side of your family. What was that? What was that like for you? Because if I understood correctly from the book, a lot of the backstory of your mom's family was unknown to you for most of your life.
Yeah. I mean, again, if I had never joined the military, there never would have been a background check that kind of highlighted these things that I didn't know. And you're specifically speaking about the the chapter where I found out that, you know, my mother's family is from North Korea, which is something, you know, I didn't know. And it was actually horrifying to find out, you know, when you've got two federal agents sitting in front of you and telling you that you're related to, you know, someone that fought for an enemy of the state.
Right. This is, I should just say, this is a very amazing scene where you're working at, I believe it's a coffee shop.
Yeah. I'm working at a coffee shop, and I have two federal agents pull me out of the coffee shop. And, you know, I'd never been in trouble with the law. I just remember thinking about, like, my years of, like, Napster and LimeWire downloads had, like, caught up with me, and I was going to jail for, you know, downloading, you know, whatever album was out. You know, they kept asking me if I'm a communist sympathizer, and then they finally let me know that, you know, my grandfather, who I had knew very little about, served in the North Korean army. My grandfather on my other side of the family, he fought in the Korean War as well. So, you know, on a different timeline, my two grandfathers could have killed each other on the battlefield, and, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here having this interview with you right now.
Yeah. Well, hearing you describe all of this, someone who hasn't read the book yet might assume that, like, oh, well, there was this legacy of service in your family. That must be what pushed Dylan to want to serve. But that's not actually true, as I understand it. It was something else. What called you to serve?
You know, I was kind of bored. I was kind of lost. I actually grew up not too far from the Pat Tillman family. I was actually at his memorial at the Rose Garden in San Jose. And I don't know what it was, but something in that moment, you know, you're like an impressionable 18-year-old, 19-year-old, however old I was at the time. And you're talking about a man who's making millions of dollars playing football. And he gave up that dream to serve his country. And however, you know, flawed that may have been, there was something incredibly poignant about that. It was just a moment where I said, you know what, like, I need to do something with my life.
That's an incredible moment in the book, I have to say, because I remember thinking, reading that, you talk very vividly about hearing Tillman, I think it's his brother, get up and speak. And he says, you know, Pat would want me to say that he is dead. Like, you know, it's not like he's alive and his spirit lives on. Like, he wouldn't want it romanticized. Yeah. He is dead. This killed him. And it's walking out of that moment where you're like, I think I should join the military. It's a very stirring moment.
Yeah. And, you know, looking back on it, you'd think that that would actually propel me to do the opposite, you know, like start get back in school. But again, I was a confused 18-year-old.
But it's very interesting, too, because one of the other things that you write about is how much, as a kid in particular, you really kind of buckled against authority, particularly when you were in Catholic school. There was a real streak in you of wanting to kind of call out what you saw as some hypocrisy there.
You know, ironically, my parents took me out of public school as a child and put me in this private school to kind of like get me away from, you know, the trouble they thought I was going to be in if I stayed in public school. And What they didn't know was that putting me in private school was like a fast track to that delinquency. Because before that, I'd never seen drugs. I, you know, didn't really know what sex was. Like, I hadn't experienced any of these things. But then you put me in a school with, you know, surrounded by a bunch of rich kids who have never been in trouble before and, you know, can get away with whatever they want. It was just a different world. Religion and the military are for me personally, anyways, have been two of the most kind of hateful experiences that I've gone through, which is a weird thing, you know, because ironically, you join this institution, or, you know, I'm speaking about the military, and, you know, the whole thing is like the land of the free, the home of the brave, blah, blah, blah. But when I joined the military, I'd never experienced that much racism in my entire life. It was a normal thing in the military, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I almost get the sense in hearing you talk about it that it was almost more of a pursuit of truth than, I don't know, defending democracy or something that prompted you to join. Am I going too far with that?
Yeah, it's you're totally correct. I guess I just thought, like, there's got to be something bigger.
Well, some of the truths that you discover are really painful. One of them has to do with this kid that you meet during your deployment in Iraq named Brahim. Tell us who Brahim was and how you struck up a relationship with him.
Brahim was just one of these local kids who, he was a local national, and you just had these groups of kids who, you know, weren't always going to school because sometimes they didn't have a school to go to. And they were kind of just hanging out. It was like a little slice of normalcy in this place where you're surrounded by death. And, you know, just having some kid with a smile on his face asking, like, what music you're listening to, and kind of bonding with him over little human experiences like that, you know, made the situation, I think, better for everyone involved.
Well, I have to ask you, there is a really astonishing moment in the book related to Brahim. Mm-hmm. You leave Iraq thinking you're never going to see him again. And then you get in a cab one day in Phoenix, and Brahim is driving the cab.
And I
had to honestly put the book down when that happened. I literally said out loud, like, what?
Yeah. And for someone who just said that they're not religious, or anything like that, you know, the universe works in weird ways sometimes. But I think that's foundational to my experience as a person. My life has been full of those moments, and that's what makes me who I am, I guess.
Well, Dylan Park Pettiford is the author of Roadside: My Journey to Iraq and the Long Road Home. Dylan, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.